Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Romine at the ready, it's Football Weekly Extra. Today, allocating precious pod seconds to clubs in crisis, Pompey, Hull, Real Madrid. While football holds its breath like Big Sam in the Blackburn team bus, we ask, have Manuel Pellegrini and Phil Brown had their chips? And unlike the Man U fans at Barnsley, did they pay for them? Elsewhere, is it a bird? Is it a plane? Is it Alberto Aquilani's long-awaited Liverpool debut? Kevin McCarra fills us in on that and more Carling Cup news. There's the midweek round in Italy. Juve groovy with Samp and another happy finish for Napoli. Your post and a look forward to the weekend's Premier League clashes in Football Weekly Extra. Now then, right, is that a bus pass in your pocket or are you just pleased to see me, Barry Glendening?
I'm very pleased to see you.
Hey, excellent. As I am to you, Sean Ingle also on board the Good Ship Pod today.
Hello, James.
Hi, Sean. And Kevin McCarra.
Thrilled to be here.
Well, it's a thrill to have you here, Kevin. Fresh from the Emirates, where, of course, yesterday you were witness to a terrific bit of Carling Cup football. Arsenal's game with Liverpool.
I've been bribed by Carling, and I think it's a smashing tournament, much underappreciated. It was a terrific game last night. I mean, people were getting in quite cheap, great atmosphere. Both teams are very serious about it, and there was plenty of quality on the pitch. What more could you ask for?
Well, indeed, Wonk posting in saying, question for Kevin McCarra, have you ever seen a more joyful or exuberant game than the Arsenal-Liverpool affair last night? Carling Cup fast becoming his favourite competition too. Plenty of families taking up the 10 quid tickets. Crowd of 60,000. Looking forward to a good game. Players who look like they might actually be enjoying themselves rather than afraid of making mistakes.
It was a surprise. I mean, being a bitter and twisted old journalist, I went along thinking, here we go, Carling Cup. And then realised there's nothing wrong with this. I mean, there's lots of players who've been injured or whoever are trying to get into the first team, trying to make their names. Youngsters playing who've got things to play for. And also, there only are three domestic trophies. Why on earth would you write off one of them? Especially in the case of Arsene Wenger, whose last trophy was the FA Cup in 2005. A League Cup would go down well if they could do that. But the appetite of the players was terrific as well. It's hard to know of these Arsenal youngsters which of them, if any, will make it. But Merida last night, for example, scored a good goal. Maybe you can fault the goalkeeper, but I think it's a great shot. And also I was involved in setting up a second. So a very productive night for him, Spanish teenager.
Aquilani?
Well, I mean, for 13 minutes, a big impression. People had assumed Alonso's gone and they signed him, therefore he must be the new Alonso. And from the beginning, Rafael Benitez has said that's not the case. He's actually an attacking midfield player, and we saw that last night. He was dangerous in his 13 minutes. I don't think it was a penalty, but he caused a bit of havoc at the end of that shot, which came off the arms of Senderos. So Senderos wasn't trying to handle, didn't have his arms out. But he looked menacing. I think, too, it showed you something about Liverpool. It may not be working, but Benitez has tried to give him a far more attacking look, whether by buying Glenn Johnson overlapping right back, or bringing in Nsua at left back. They are trying to evolve and not bore the living daylights out of people so much. And so far, they've had very poor reward for their adventurousness.
Defeat last night, does this plunge them back into crisis? Yeah. Or?
Well, it's meltdown. I think you have to resign. It's funny enough, it does make it five defeats out of six, but given the nature of the lineups, I think that'd be very cruel to view it as a black mark against Benitez.
Now, all the big teams seem to win, apart from Liverpool. Man United, the big news about their clash with Barnsley, though, was the unfortunate business in the chip shop, Sean Ingle.
Well, yeah, it was. I wouldn't call it more than unfortunate. A gang of United fans weren't very happy. Stormed a food kiosk. Had the workers cowering in fear as they nicked food and coins and money and all sorts of other things.
Wow!
And threw some food onto the pitch as well, which wasn't very nice if you're a steward. My uncle Jimmy, who as previous listeners will know,
right,
former steward at Luton Town.
I bet no one threw pies at him.
They did. They might have threw beer at him, but then he probably just opened his mouth and sucked it up.
Right, I don't know if that's fair to him.
No, but it is. He drank 14 cans of Carling the week before last.
Yeah,
I remember someone at
one
the,
night.
Someone at the Den threw a meat pie at a player.
Really?
And there was a huge debate raging on 606 afterwards. That Danny Baker was in the hot seat and he, trying to establish whether or not a meat pie or a half-eaten meat pie counted as a missile, or was it just discarded food?
Well, equally, the question is applicable to the famous pig's head at the Real Madrid Barcelona game. Luis Figo was the
that wasn't cooked, was it? It didn't
have
an apple in its
mouth. I don't
think
so, but you know, this is Spanish cuisine we're talking about.
I was going to take it back to the Man U fans being involved in this, because we all have this cliche now, oh, they're all corporate and middle class. And, you know, they're actually
maybe
they were
just outright, there were no prawn sandwiches.
No, but I do think we sometimes fail to realise that football hasn't changed that much. I mean, that there is still elements of menace and disruption within the...
And according to police, more Manchester United fans have been arrested for football-related offences than any other club in the last year.
I was kind of surprised that there was a chipper in Oakwell that was sort of salubrious enough to have thousands of pounds worth of damage done to it.
But where was the kiosk?
Well, it was in Oakwell, the Barnsley ground.
Right, actually in the stadium.
The United supporters, the reason they got so irate was because they wouldn't serve them any booze. So I think they just leapt the counter and held themselves to the...
I'm with Barry. I've been to Oakwell a couple of times, actually, and there are nicer grounds. It's a more old-fashioned authentic. I mean, I've enjoyed watching football there, but the chips aren't fried in a gold-plated deep-fat fryer.
They're not.
And they're not diamond-encrusted.
Do you think they'd be nicer if they were?
This is relevant how? Sorry.
The fact that thousands of pounds worth of damage was
caused.
Oh,
I see. Right. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So where is all this damage? Now, in other Carling Cup news, Portsmouth have they had a very big win over Stoke, but that's where the good news ended, because they also found themselves transfer embargoed. They owe £1 million to Chelsea over deferred payments on the purchase of Glenn Johnson, and have a similar situation with Diarra. Yet more bad news for Pompey, and yet more question marks over their future, etc., etc. How serious is this? Can they get this lifted if they can pay the cash?
It's a fairly small amount of money, but I just think it's amazing the vast profits they realise in these players like Glenn Johnson, you know, and Diarra, of course, to Real Madrid. It seems that they've taken in tens of millions, and it's made no great impression on their finances. In fact, they're in financial troubles. We know they've been taken over. You wonder about the viability of bringing insufficient revenue in a fairly old-fashioned ground, and you wonder why these people want to get involved.
So do you think the money's disappeared into Pompey, or has it disappeared into some external source? Has that ever been... Well, Short Ingalls' eyebrows are racing skywards.
Well, no, I think the whole situation is very, very murky, I think Portsmouth is a particularly murky club, and anything more I think would invite.
They did spend beyond their means as well, though. I mean, but certainly they claim simply to have lost money in general trading, don't they?
Since winning the FA Cup, I mean, the famous figure that David James, their goalkeeper, was banding around was £80 million raised, and that figure will have increased since he wrote that article, or had it ghostwritten for him, as Sean now reveals. Where has that money gone, if anybody knows? They're far from being the only team in crisis.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah, because you've also got, let's see, on our crisis watch here on Football Weekly Extra, Hull, where not only have they been told they need fresh investment, or the viability of the club is in question within the next few months, I think, possibly. But also, the bookies yesterday had stopped taking bets on Phil Brown's departure from the club. The club have said that he's still their manager. But the chairman resigned this morning, and you feel, Barry, that Phil may not be too far behind.
I would suggest there's a very good chance he'll be gone by the time this podcast is put up on the website. Mm. So if he'd be doing well to last the day, today being Thursday.
I mean, you look at his record over the last... I was looking at it earlier. Last calendar year, Hull have played 39 Premier League matches and lost 23 of them and only won 6. I mean, they have a shocking record. Interestingly, I was looking on their website as well. Yesterday, Hull announced a major recycling initiative, asking fans to donate their old clothes to good use. And Phil Brown said, you know, please do your best for recycling. And obviously, Hull seem to have done some recycling of their own, because not only is Paul Duffin, the former chairman, gone, there's speculation Adam Pearson, who bought the club for £360,000 8 years ago and then sold it for £13 million, making a huge wedge. There's speculation that he will be back. So all change at Hull.
They're terrified of relegation. It's been reported they'll have to raise £23 million to meet existing liabilities if they do go down. So,
but it's a bit bleak.
You chase the dream, you know, just like several other clubs have done. And if you fail, you end up probably tumbling down to League Two.
Right, get the book of chickens coming home, quite literally, to roost. Now, north of the border, the situation not much sunnier, Kevin. A lot of comment on our talk about Rangers in Monday's pod. And as far as I can tell, the new policy guideline set by Posters is we're allowed to talk about the SPL if there's somebody with a Mac in their surname. Kevin, you're filling that role admirably today. We talked about Rangers and their trouble. I know Barry's bursting with fresh info on that score. But Kevin, Celtic, problems there as well.
Well, not financial problems. The club is well run, much to the annoyance of supporters who'd rather they were losing, get into debt and buying some better players. The squad has deteriorated markedly since the days of, you know, John Hartson and Chris Sutton. And these people were very good players for Celtic. Oh, of course, Henrik Larsson. Got to UEFA Cup final in 2003, etc. But the edict came down, I think, that we have to balance the books, and that's they're now playing very, very substandard players. Although Hearts, of course, have an even smaller budget and beat Celtic at home last night. So Tony Mowbray has made a pretty poor impression. He's got a reputation for playing good football, but the fact of the matter is he came bottom of the Premier League and still got the Celtic job, which I think would not have happened in the past. Celtic, it seems, were turned down by Owen Coyle, who preferred to stay at Burnley, which tells you much about the reduced status of Scottish football. But in terms of real threat, of course, they're not in as much difficulty as Rangers. I mean, when you think of the holding company, David Murray's company, who have Rangers as part of their group, had a net debt of £760 million in the most recent accounts. So people talk about Rangers being £30 million in debt, but I think it's actually a much bigger picture than that.
I was listening to a podcast that was on the Daily Record website.
Sid Lowe on it?
No, he wasn't. I was going in search of opinions which I'd be able to pass off as my own, as is customary. But interestingly, Rangers in the 1880s needed a bailout from the president, a guy called George Gowdy, because they were saddled with a debt of £30.
Right. Okay. Well, they got themselves out of that hole. So there's hope, perhaps this time as well.
But the guys who were on that doing that chat about Rangers, they seemed to know what they were talking about, and they reckon that Rangers, the reason they're being pursued by the banks is because it's convenient for them to chase Murray's business, which is ruined because of the recession.
Cynical, one of our posters who returned to the posting boards this week, very welcome return. He also seems to know what he's talking about. He says essentially they're not in an administration but will be put into an administration at the end of the season unless a buyer investor is found, and should that be the case, the banks basically plan to sell the first team and replace it with the under-21s. The only putative purchaser is Dave King, who's presently facing around 220 charges of fraud and tax avoidance, and would thus probably sail through a fit and proper person's test. He says the problems at Rangers are a combination of three factors: reckless Leeds-style overspending in the 90s, David Murray's problems elsewhere in his business empire, and the fact that in happier times, Rangers, says V. Sinicar, could rely on being treated favourably by Scottish banks, but since HBOS got taken over by Lloyds TSB, this cosy arrangement no longer applies.
I mean, but the general shift was, of course, at one time Rangers were well off because of income at the gates, and they could buy Terry Butcher and so on. But then TV money became everything, and TV money in Scotland is negligible.
But if the banks do, or if Lloyds do sell everything that isn't nailed down at Ibrox and Rangers slip down the table, then their fans would all sort of presumably desert Ibrox in droves, but also desert those of them that do business with Lloyds Bank would probably desert Lloyds as well.
They'll take the overdraft somewhere else, is that what you're saying?
Or have their Dole money put into an account with a different bank.
I've read this thing about boycotting Lloyds. I bet they're quaking in their boots.
It's a bit strong, Sean, isn't it?
Yeah, that was totally uncalled for.
Totally
I apologise.
Right, okay.
I can't help myself. I really tried to do a thing about Scottish football today without making a snide remark, and I failed again.
Right.
I apologise.
All right. As always, next week, Barry. That's it for part one. Very, very shortly, we'll be having a quick word with Sid Lowe on the extraordinary state of things at Real Madrid, a club in crisis par excellence. That and the latest from Italy coming up after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
For the latest from the madcap world of football, just go to guardian.co.uk/football, where you can find out what's going on, with whom and why. And you can also post, of course, at the Football Weekly page therein, and we'll be looking at some of your posts a little bit later on. Right now, though, time for the doctor. Yeah. Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. How's the atmosphere there?
tense, as you can imagine, tense and I'd say expectant as much as anything else, because of course what's happening now is everybody's going through the various possibilities of who can replace Manuel Pellegrini,
right,
if, well, not so much if, when he gets the sack.
All right, now just to backtrack a little bit here, this is Real Madrid who has assembled the finest players that money can buy, and Jerzy Dudek as well, and they draw one game, and then they lose at home to Milan in the Champions League, then they draw in that goalless game with Sporting Gijón, and now they've lost 4-0 to Alcopops or something?
That's the one. 4-0 to Alcopops. 4-0 to Alcorcón, who are a side in Spain's second division B. Now, try and put this into context. Second division B is split into four 20-team groups. So although it's the third tier, in other words, there's first division, second division A and second division B, although it's the third tier, there's 80 teams in that third tier. So you're talking about something that's closer to a conference side, really, than a league side. So to put it in context maybe a little bit more, this is a side that plays in the same league as Real Madrid's youth team. Real Madrid's youth team, have played them seven times and only been beaten by them once. Real Madrid, who've played them once and been beaten 4-0 by them.
Right, and this despite fielding Van der Vaart, Benzema, Giara, who else? Gago, a lot of top-name players.
Raul, Guti, I mean, you know, they did leave out some players, as is always the way in the Copa del Rey, because it's treated a little bit like the Carling Cup, but not really. I mean, there wasn't a single youth teamer in the Real Madrid team. Maybe they should have been, as it turns out. And the side that went onto the pitch cost Madrid €110 million.
But Sid, this was a local derby, so surely the form book goes out the window.
Well, it's a local derby, but not really for Real Madrid. Alcorcón, the south of the city, if they have a local rival, it would be Atletico Madrid. In fact, it wouldn't even be Atletico Madrid. It would be Getafe. In fact, no, it wouldn't even be. It would be Leganés. So right. Real Madrid are some way down on the scale of local rivals. Although the guy who scored twice, I think, might well be half of Spain's new footballing hero. He's now played Real Madrid and scored six goals against them for three different teams in the Copa del Rey every time for a lower division team, getting goals against Real Madrid.
Wow.
So can I ask you, I mean, right, the 3-0 at half-time, which is catastrophic. It seems amazing that they then lose another goal. Wouldn't you expect some sort of major response in the second half? Is that probably the biggest problem of Pellegrini?
Well, the big response at half-time was Guti turning around to Pellegrini and telling him to go and take it up the arse. So I suppose that probably explains what happened in the second half. Guti came into the dressing room, according to a report from one of the few journalists in Spain I really trust. Guti came into the dressing room and basically started haranguing his players and saying, come on, we've got to show a bit more, we've got to show more fight, we've got to show more spirit. To which the coach says, well, you can show a bit more too. Guti said, well, if I'm the problem, take me off then. So the coach said, okay, get dressed. So then Guti stormed out, telling the coach to take it somewhere. Went out onto the bench, sat on the bench, still in his kit, then was eventually persuaded to go back inside and change properly. And that's just an indication of the tension. I don't think it's necessarily an indication really, really deep problems, because of course 3-0 down at half time against Alcorcón, you're going to get pissed off. That's the way it works.
We should point out, obviously some listeners might not know, this is only the first of a two-legged game, so Madrid could still turn it around, and they have done so in the past, haven't they?
Van der Vaart next, pointing that out in the post. I seem to remember them losing the first leg of a cup tie 4-0 and then winning the second leg 5-0 a few years ago in the Beckham era.
I suspect, actually, that the case they're talking about there is Real Zaragoza. Real Madrid lost 6-1 in the first leg away at the Romareda. In the second leg, obviously, they had to win 5-0 to go through, because 6-1, they got the away goal. They were 4-0 up. I think they were 3-0 up after 10 minutes, Real Madrid. It was an extraordinary occasion. They were throwing men forward. Everything was mad. It was a really brilliant, brilliant night to be at the Santiago Bernabeu. And with half an hour to go, Madrid had got four of the five goals they needed. And in the end, they didn't make it, and they didn't go through. But Madrid certainly are a club that historically have done lots of very famous comebacks, particularly in European competition in the mid-80s. And that's something that they're clinging to, because they're saying if any team knows how to come back, it's Real Madrid. Obviously, what they're forgetting is, yeah, well, okay, but recent history suggests that they don't. In the Copa del Rey, they were knocked out by Betis. They were knocked out by Real Unión, for example, last season. So maybe it's not necessarily in their favour. But this is one of the problems of the Spanish Copa del Rey, the fact that it's two-legged.
Right. Interesting. Pellegrini, though, Real Madrid may be bouncing back, but is his goose cooked?
Well, his goose, in a way, has always been cooked. In the under Florentino Pérez, of course, coaches are always devoid of authority to some extent. He was not Perez's choice. Perez wanted Wenger or Mourinho, and then Pellegrini came in because Valdano suggested him as an alternative when those options came to nothing for Real Madrid, and also Ancelotti as well, and Rafa Benitez had already said no to them, although Benitez's relationship with Valdano is such that he'd have never gone there anyway. So his goose is cooked in that sense. I do think, for what it's worth, that Perez has publicly at least done the right thing. I mean, this is a club that lacks calmness, lacks tranquility in key moments like this. And he came out yesterday, Perez, and said, look, it's a new coach, it's a new squad. We've got to be calm, we've got to be patient. The thing is, of course, we don't have that patience. Now, he's saying it publicly. The reality, I think, privately is that a defeat against Getafe and or Milan, and I think Pellegrini could well be a goner.
All right, and who... Say the words Fenger and Eriksson, make us happy here. Who?
Go on, I want
who's
to.
In the pole position?
Well, let me tell you the words you want to hear. There's as you can imagine, long list of potential candidates in all the Madrid papers, and both of the main sports dailies in Madrid have included Fenger and Eriksson in the list. I suppose in some ways he is what Real Madrid want. He's a big name, but a weak coach, a coach who will allow himself to be moulded by the club to some extent. He's a coach whose main interest is money. Hey, that suits. And he's a coach who's shown before that he can work with the stars, albeit not always to huge success.
Wow, and he can probably get Sol Campbell on board as well.
Well, there you go. That would be a bonus, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. Oh, I should also mention before you go, here we go, posting in from Finland some weeks ago. Her 9-year-old son offered to do a swap of an HJK tea mug. You know the name of the team involved, don't you, Barry?
I can't remember.
For a Crewe Alexander mug with your dad. Basically, he offered to swap one of these HJK tea mugs for one of your father's Crewe Alexander mugs, but got no response. So what do you know about this, Sid?
I don't know anything about it. Did aforementioned 9-year-old... at my dad directly or go to the garden?
I don't know. Can you pass this on, or whether that piece of would that be crockery or what?
Surely, you know, he could, a 9-year-old boy. I was reminded of the scene from Oliver Twist there with this little urchin shuffling up to your dad holding out a mug and being cruelly rebuffed.
That is why I find it very hard to believe that my dad actually rejected this. I'm sure if he's offered this mug and he's aware of it, he would gladly swap it for a Crewe Alexander.
Nice one. And we look forward to hearing all about anything else that may happen over the weekend in Monday's show.
Fantastic. See you then.
Thanks, Sid. Extraordinary stuff there. Sid Lowe in Spain, of course. And possibly the bizarrest element of the whole thing is the fact that Sid got through that entire report without saying rubbish once. If ever there was an occasion to wheel out that epithet, that was it.
Hang on a minute. Should we ring him back?
Let's ring him back. Yeah. There you go. Well, the sister in fine form there. And looking forward to hearing the latest chapter of that next week. In the meantime, though, they were busy in Italy midweek, where they had a full round of midweek matches. And some juicy affairs there were too. Juventus, who'd been scraping their way to victories in the last couple of games, mainly thanks to that little-known keeper Gigi Buffon's efforts in goal, finally came good. They hosted Sampdoria, who were their rivals for the role of anti-Inter in the title race, and they absolutely tore them apart. 5-1. Gigi Buffon barely had to make a save. Amaury got a couple, and they just looked fantastic, and the papers are raving about their new formation. Diego is brilliant, etc., etc., etc. So Juve very much back in form. Inter haven't played yet. They're playing tonight against Palermo, so we'll see what happens there. But in the meantime, the other big, big game was Milan's trip to Naples to take on Napoli. I don't know if anybody saw this.
Absolute humdinger of a game.
Terrific game. Terrific atmosphere as well. San Paolo packed out. You know, big, big crowd, lots of ticker tape and sparklers in the crowd and all that kind of thing. And terrific start to the game as well. Milan fired up, perhaps, by this atmosphere. We're 2-0 up inside the first 6 minutes. A performance that was actually mirrored, happily enough, by Napoli, who in the final 6 minutes managed to equalise with two goals. Fine goals that were two, so a 2-2 draw.
I was very impressed with Dida, who's copped a lot of criticism. Yeah. Although the Napoli fans seem to take Frankie Goes to Hollywood's through of hit me.
I know why you're doing
lazy
this.
Laser beams a bit to heart, because he was complaining about people firing lasers at
yes.
him, wasn't he?
Yeah, they were trying to target his vision with their little red dots. Barry, why did Sean Ingle make that rather cumbersome analogy?
Because it emerged this yes. morning in our pre-pod chat that you have spent time
yep.
at the front of a Frankie I Goes was, to Hollywood gig.
I was very excited back in the, you know, the, in the first wave of Frankie excitement. But let's revise that. The wave of Frankie excitement. You know, right when they were still at the height of their Relax and Two Tribes, power, pomp, etc. I managed to secure a front row seat for their gig.
A seat?
Yeah, it was at the Hammersmith Odeon. You had seats in those days.
Probably rock and roll.
Yeah. It was quite actually. But anyway, there I was at the front, from which vantage point I was able to not only pluck a plectrum discarded by whoever was playing guitars for them.
Pedro Gil?
No, I don't think any. I think that's right. The lads, or whatever they were called.
Well, there was Frankie, and then there was Paul Rutherford.
No, there was Paul Rutherford and Holly Johnson, who did nothing. And then there was the lads. Yeah.
Holly Johnson.
Yeah.
Pedro Gil was one of the. And someone, Nash, was it?
Yeah, my name was Nash, and I used to slash. There was a famous B-side from one of those.
Were you typical of the Frankie audience?
I had no idea who else was there, because I only had eyes for Paul and Holly. And before anybody starts sneering or, you know, pointing, chortling fingers, let me point out, Barry, that you went to an Erasure concert, which is a million times more regrettable.
I've already got abuse in the podcast for admitting that that I was at an Erasure gig.
Yeah.
And you never mentioned anything about your sordid Frankie Goes to Hollywood gig-going shame.
Right, okay. So, you're going to some kind of Cranberries tribute act, are you, or something?
What?
You the zombie costume that arrived in the post.
Oh, I'm going to a fancy dress party on Saturday night, dressed as a zombie. I'm not sure if anyone will notice the difference or anything. If anyone sees...
They will notice the difference. I've seen Barry's costume. It arrived this morning in a brown paper box, and I thought this could be interesting. It was a very, very fine piece of...
It's a different kind of material that he normally gets in his brown paper box as well.
Is that so, Sean Ingle? Now, I was halfway through... Yeah, Dida. There we are. He was extraordinarily bad against Real Madrid, and he's been very good since. And he pulled off a string of cracking saves at the start of the second half. But I think this game was always going to... It always looked like it was heading towards a draw, because once Milan had got the two goals, Nesta then went off, and he's been their best player far and away for the last couple of games. And it was all Napoli in the second half. And then Abate got sent off. This young midfielder stroke right back. And he was the only person who was actually doing any running for Milan. That did rather hamper them. So anyway, Milan get a point still. Very decent result.
Can I just ask as well? I was also watching the Genoa v Fiorentina game, which was a cracking match. Mm. And Hernan Crespo, who I haven't seen much of, most of the time he's been on the bench, obviously with Inter, but I was very impressed with him, even though he didn't score. What have the Italian papers been making of him at Genoa?
Well, they didn't, as you say, he's not been playing very much there either. And they're really excited about Palladino's goal in that game, the Bacchio, extraordinary stuff. I personally didn't see that myself. I was busy with the San Paolo business, and Milan, who on Sunday, they're now fifth, Milan, so they did move up a little bit in the table. They play the team in fourth, who are?
Parma.
Oh, nice one, Barry. Parma, yeah. Good for them, eh? And
I like Parma, actually. I have a soft spot for Parma ever since they used to feature on your old Gazzetta.
Back in the days when, thanks to...
Tanzi and some were pouring the money in, is that right?
They were pouring pensioners' money in to return.
Yes.
And buying all sorts of players and doing... With Nevio Scala, do you remember him?
You used to go there quite a lot, did you? You interviewed
They were lovely folk.
Asprilia and Brolin. Was Asprilia really as mad as a...
He was mad, wasn't he? He was mad. But they were there. Risto Stoichkov was there. They had some lovely people there. The other bit of Italian football news, which you mentioned, the Roman clubs, who are looking all played out. Roma had their third straight league defeat, losing 2-1 at Udinese. They have all sorts of players out. But you just get the feeling with them, as with Lazio, that... They're basically running on empty. I mean, Roma, everybody knows that they're £350 million in debt. They're the holding company who actually control Roma. And it's a question of when the people who are in charge of that holding company finally sell up, that the club can actually move on. Lazio, who haven't won in Serie A since August, had a training ground invasion by 200 happy fans this week. After which they went and lost 1-0 at home to Cagliari, which is not the best, really. I did like Captain Tommaso Rocchi, when the fans invaded the training ground, just like in the good old days. He got a loud hailer and apologised on behalf of the team and said, "We're also disappointed at what's happening, but do not for one second think that those who step on the field don't give their best. From now on, we'll push even harder to get back to winning ways." Now, I think that's a contradictory message. My understanding of best is there's nowhere else for you to go.
Christian Vieri, by
yes,
the way.
Yes,
he's been
you.
in the news. Is he going to Brazil or not?
Well, no, we had a bit of a Vieri special, scary Christian Vieri, on Monday's show, and all sorts of people responding. Parker Boy, for example, I'm sure someone once told me that Vieri was much more interested in cricket than football. Is that true? Yes, Parker Boy. In fact, he said that if there was as much money in cricket as there was in football, he would have played that instead. And
sorry, I thought that was another euphemism.
What? No,
more
he genuinely
in
is more interested
than football.
And as KM Poe points out, his favourite sportsman was actually Alan Border. And he claims, KM Poe, claims that that Christian's brother Max Vieri, actually made a couple of appearances for the Australian national team. But I really don't think that's true. Maybe he means the Australian national football team because Max was very much a footballer. Indeed, Max, curiously enough, played once at Ancona in Serie B with Eddie Baggio. So you had Baggio and Vieri in the same team, but it was Eddie Baggio and Max Vieri. So it wasn't quite the same thing. A bit like having a podcast with Brian Inkle and Frank Glendening.
Or Gary Richardson.
Gary Richardson. Yeah, my brother.
Still people wonder, is he your brother or isn't he? I know the answer, but I'm not going to tell.
Well, I will tell that he's not my brother. This comes of me trying to be glib in an interview where they said, Gary Richardson, you know, is he in any relation? I thought, well, I'll just be so ridiculous about this that they'll understand. So I said, yes, he is. And can you tell him, you know, Mum asked him to call home. And they said, yeah, Mum asked to call home. Happy to be of service, etc. And there you go. Anyway, now, there will be more posts very, very shortly. We're going to have one of our little musical stings and then hear one or two other thoughts from listeners and have a look forward to a big weekend in the Premier League. Part three, my favourite. Sizow79 says, could you possibly arrange an AC Jimbo versus B Glendening charity boxing match to release some of their built-up animosity?
Who'd win if you two squared off?
I think Barry.
I think in terms of, it'd be like David Haye against Nikolai Valuev.
Right.
In terms of size, yes. And because you're like the trash-talking pretty boy, whereas I'm more ugly, thoughtful, philosophical fighter. I think I'd win, but you'd fight dirty.
See, I think if it was a boxing match, Barry would keep it at bay on the jab. Yeah. But if it was an ultimate fighting championship, you'd win because you have Brazilian jiu-jitsu skills.
That's right. I do have ground skills.
Yeah, I've no skills whatsoever.
No, Barry, you know, he moves fast for a big man. Listeners may know that you and I have actually boxed together.
We have.
Only through the medium of, you know, Nintendo Wii. Yeah.
I think you kicked my ass.
No, I don't think I did actually, Barry. And your tennis serve was a phenomenal thing. As long as there's no actual tennis court involved, you're a real champ.
I was quite a good tennis player in my day.
Oh, were you? Yeah. All right. There you go. Dida for Chuckle Vision, touching on the hot potato of the guy potentially getting banned from the New Den for wearing the Galatasaray shirt, which, if we were unclear about this, unbelievably stupid thing to do. Does he get banned for life for wearing a football jersey? I don't know. How does a rule like that...
I've seen a photo of the guy and the two guys with him. I think they've been punished enough by the lottery of life, to be honest, and banning them from Millwall isn't really going to make that much difference. I was banned from the Swan nightclub in Stockwell for a crime, I hasten to add, I did not commit.
Right.
And you would think the bouncer would say, you know, forget after a while. Pardon?
What crime?
An associate of mine may have vomited on the counter of a bar.
Right.
It wasn't me.
Right.
It was not me.
Because you can't dust for vomit. You could never prove that, of course.
Presumably genetics or something, or DNA, whatever. Anyway, I got the blame for it, and when I went to go back there again, this is many years ago, I hasten to add, I don't go to those kind of places anymore, the bouncer recognised me, and continued to recognise me for about four more futile attempts of mine to gain access to this nocturnal emporium of bad music and cheap apple sours and lager.
So that's what the zombie costume is really all about then, Barry.
No, I've no desire to ever go back dark in its doorsteps again.
Okay. Atom Bomb, two questions from this weekend's Liverpool-Man United game. Will Halloween kids turn up at Vidic and Rio's house wearing Torres masks? And now that Vidic has had three successive red cards against Liverpool, does he get to keep one permanently? Interesting question. Liam Whitey says he needs a banker this week in the Premier League for a win in the last man competition. Don't know what that means, but can't be Arsenal, Chelsea or Man U. Who would you go for? Is there a result out there?
Stoke to beat Wolves.
Okay, there you go. Meantime, Kevin, you're going to be... why?
I just think Wolves aren't very good. They don't have Stoke at home. Yeah. Stoke are doing well. Yeah. They're going to bombard Wolves defenders and with high balls, and I think the Wolves defenders won't be able for it.
Stoke's record against the bottom 10 sides in the Premier League over the last season and a half has been fantastic. I mean, they won 10 last season. They've won 3 out of 5 at home this season, only lost to Chelsea and Man U. They are pretty much even money. Which, you know, just have a 50% chance to win. I think it's higher than that.
Arsenal v Tottenham is one of the key, the marquee fixtures of this weekend's action. And Kevin, you will be in the Emirates for that match.
I've not seen much of Arsenal this season, and last night's game obviously a different lineup entirely from the one on Saturday. A highly placed source at the Guardian does complain to him about Spurs and says that right back and central midfield are still huge problem areas. What intrigues me is that Arsenal, we're talking about losing goals. They lose a lot of goals, and I'm only looking at TV, but you get the impression that they don't have the same resilience in midfield. Very good players like Song and so on, but teams seem to play through them quite easily and get chances. And,
right.
Maybe that's an area that...
Do Spurs have that resilience? Do they have the personnel to exploit that lack of resilience?
Oh, I think Spurs can score goals. I think they'll concede them as well. I mean, I imagine I kind of envisage a scoring draw or something.
Well, 4-4 last year. It was an amazing game.
True, but that was a blip. Spurs, before then, had only scored 8 goals at Highbury.
Under one.
In 15 games. And Arsenal, I think, won 9 out of the 16 matches in the Premier League. So, you know, Arsenal do normally win at home against Spurs.
Right. Meantime, Chelsea are at Bolton. Anything to say about that?
Away win. Chelsea won the last 6 at the Reebok, scored 10 goals, haven't conceded one against.
But when they played Wigan away, it didn't work out for them. That's a shrug, listeners. That was a shrug.
Chelsea just beat Bolton like 4-0 last
night. Oh, in the Carling Cup thing.
So,
Do you think that might have some bearing on the way the weekend's game might go?
Historically, reading through one of my betting books, when two sides play each other within a short amount of period, and there normally is a case during the season where they, you know, around the Christmas time where there'll be reverse fixtures, maybe 3 or 4 weeks apart. It's statistically rarer for the same team to win both games than it otherwise would be, and I don't know why that is, but maybe because they're sort of relatively fresh, and the team that's lost doesn't want to lose again, so it has the
other one takes their foot off the gas a bit.
Getting back to Chelsea, it's interesting. Kalou scored last night and the goals last week against Atletico Madrid. I've often puzzled at what the point of him is and what he's meant to be good at, but suddenly he does seem to be coming to life under Ancelotti. I don't know whether he's just matured or he's been coached differently. But
I guess with Drogba having some injury niggles, you know, Bolton might have put up a better performance. But the stats suggest that Chelsea, you know, should win.
Right, Everton, who are having a bit of a crisis, not sure if their injury situation improves, does it, for the visit of Aston Villa this weekend?
Everything's wrong with them, isn't it? The results are... It's so unlike a David Moyes team to... I mean, despite the injuries, you think it's... the lack of organisation must be driving them crazy.
Right. Man United will be hosting Swine Flu's Blackburn Rovers, who may still be benefited with from that lack of contact from Big Sam Allardyce. It's a tall order, that one.
It is. I don't think they've won once, I think, in the Premier League at Old Trafford in 2005.
Ooh.
So it's unlikely. They normally score, I think, but they don't normally win.
All right, then. Other games, Portsmouth, Wigan, Stoke, Wolverhampton, we talked about that. Sunderland are hosting West Ham. You'll be confident about that one, Barry, will you?
Will I be confident?
Yeah, about Sunderland.
I will be. My only concern would be that West Ham are going there on the back of a great performance against Arsenal last night.
All right. Fulham-Liverpool. Who's fit for this? Does Steven Gerrard, will he be back? Torres, is he still fit?
I think Dietrich is saying Gerrard's still problematic.
Right.
Yeah, but
And Torres presumably is still fit, having managed to last the...
Well, they didn't play him last night, so I assume he's okay. I imagine he's being held in reserve.
All right, he's in phenomenal form, isn't he? Torres.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think the last couple of matches Liverpool have won, Craven Cottage, they have a pretty good record there, so they'll probably fancy their chances.
They've had 4 straight away defeats, though, Liverpool.
They have.
Hmm.
Isn't Hodgson, you know, aren't Fulham getting better by the
they
weekend?
They still are, but the trouble with Fulham, I think, is that they're without Andy Johnson. And I think Bobby Zamora is shocking.
Right.
I think he's terrible. He's, you know, he's enthusiastic, and the fans seem to love him.
He'll have a chance to redeem himself then against Liverpool on the weekend, and all sorts of excitements to look forward to in amongst those games. We will be looking back on the whole weekend bonanza in Monday's Football Weekly. So hopefully you'll be joining us for that, listeners. I should also point out that next Thursday, and boy, this is exciting, we're doing an extra special live and in video vodcast Football Weekly Extra. That's 7 o'clock British winter time, whatever that is, GMT. Next Thursday, the pod will be going out live and in video as well. So that's something for your diary, A. In the meantime, many thanks to producer Pete for putting today's show together. Sean, what?
What was that accent? What was that accent? It was today's show together.
I don't know. Many thanks to producer...
Like my mother's telephone voice.
Hello.
She turns into the queen any time the phone rings.
Really? Many thanks to producer Pete for putting that show together.
Now you're sounding like DJ Smashing Nicey.
I'm not.
Can't you just be sincere?
Can't I just be... And this is me.
He's trying to traumatise you, James. No. He's trying to ruin your career here, but undermining you.
Many thanks to producer Pete for putting today's show together. Sean Ingle.
Cheers, James.
Thank you, Sean. Kevin McCarra.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, Kevin. Barry Glendenning.
Copy that, Jimbo.
Outstanding. Zombie. And we'll see you on Monday.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.